This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 25th of March, 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show...
I'd like to begin by thanking the people of the United States whose generous support for my country has been of such immense value in advancing the cause of freedom.
Afghanistan's president addresses Congress, thanking America for its sacrifices. But what does Afghanistan still need from the US? Xenia Wickett and Oscar Guardiola Rivera will be joining me to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the EU joining the rush to Havana, the Thai junta's bold initiative on press regulation, Japan's hopes of recruiting a new generation of soldiers by giving away stupid smartphone games, and Washington's convulsions over what really happened to the White House. House's chief florist. We'd call it Florist Gate, but that would only make sense in the London borough of Newham. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to this evening's instalment of Midori House. My guests today are Xenia Wickett, Project Director of the US Project at Chatham House, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University, regular commentator on all things Latin America. Welcome both. We will start tonight in Washington, D.C., currently hosting the first visit to the US by Ashraf Ghani in his newish role as President of Afghanistan. His visit has already yielded at least one concrete result, a slowing of America's planned withdrawal of combat troops. Perhaps more surprisingly, President Ghani has been at pains, especially in an address to Congress, to thank America's troops and taxpayers for the sacrifices they have made for his country since 2001. Xenia, I'll ask you first. I'm very surprised myself by the effusiveness that he has demonstrated before Congress. I mean, I understand that if you're going to speak to the a joint session of Congress, you have to say nice things about America.
But you don't, as evidenced by two weeks ago.
With the occasional exception to that rule. But that would not necessarily play with large measures of the citizens he represents.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what happened with Karzai, his predecessor. You know, I mean, if you can take yourselves back a decade or so, Karzai started off with a pretty good relationship with the Americans and it went downhill pretty fast. I think what you're seeing now is Ghani very much with a view of he's in a honeymoon period. He can kind of get away with a fair amount. And he and the country recognize that they need not just the Americans, but they need the international community. And so what you're seeing is Ashraf Ghani essentially come very forward-leaning in the important recognition of what America has done or what the international community has done, and very forward-leaning in terms of trying to ensure that that attention remains. Let's fast forward another 6 months or another year, and I suspect his position might be far more nuanced.
Oscar, the thought also occurred to me that perhaps he's trying to avoid rerunning the early 90s, where in slightly different circumstances, America thought it had proved its point in Afghanistan and more or less gave up on the place, which worked out fairly badly for everybody who lived there.
That's absolutely the case. We were saying before, clearly the current Afghan president is trying to change the tone and produce a contrast with his predecessor. But perhaps the question here is not so much whether the Afghans can live without the Americans. Apparently not, but whether the Americans can live without the Afghans and leave Afghanistan. And there again, I'm afraid the answer is no. I say this because I've been reading the 150th anniversary issue of The Nation, and there was an article by William Appleman Williams there asking Americans to face the historical fact that America needs to be an empire as a way of life. And Appleman has this to say: we were already assuming that our right to security transcended the traditional right to defend what we had and had become the right to perfect security in any imaginable future contingency. The problem here is whether America will have to continue over the year that Obama has said it will continue. This is the longest war in American modern history, and the result has not been further stability and strength, the strength of the Afghani government. We're being told now that in 1 year we will have a strong enough Afghan army. If we haven't, if the Americans haven't been able to do so in almost a decade, the decade that they have been there, why are they going to do so in 1 year?
All of which is true. It's been a very long, very difficult, and very expensive war. It's a long time myself since I was in Afghanistan. I was last there, I think, 2003, but before that I'd been there in 1998. I would consider myself 2003 an improvement on what had been the case 5 years previously. But President Ghani, I think myself was being possibly somewhat optimistic when he also in his speech framed Afghanistan as part of a new Middle East, as he put it, that rejects extremism and intolerance. This from the president of a country in whose capital just last week a woman was beaten to death for apparently not even setting fire to a book of which other copies were at any rate available. Is he being untowardly optimistic, or is that just part of his job?
I think at some level that's part of his job. What leader in power do you know anywhere around the world lays out the, you know what, life is pretty awful and it's only going to get worse. It's not going to keep you in power for terribly long. So, I mean, I think it is part of his job. But, I mean, it's more than just a kind of communication strategy. I mean, he has been elected to make the situation better for Afghanistan and Afghans. Plural, the population. He will do everything in his power to do that. He right at the moment believes that partnering with outside interests, and I do want to make clear, this is not just the Americans. This is actually all a number of other countries from the ISAF forces as well. Partnering with these organizations and these nations for a bit longer is, in his view, good for the country and good for the Afghans. I think most people would agree with that. The challenge is going to be, and this is the challenge that we've seen for over a decade now, which is there's an awful lot of people in an awful lot of other countries who are starting to or have started to shrug and say, this isn't our problem. This takes too long. I mean, this is Oscar's point. It just takes too long and it uses up too much of our resources. And so the question is can the situation be improved fast enough such that you can actually withdraw resources without sacrificing the security? And that's effectively the calculation that President Obama has been making for the last 6 years and will continue to make for the next 2 years. What he announced some years ago was a withdrawal of American forces such that all troops were leaving by the end of 2016. He is keeping to that all troops withdrawing by the end of 2016. What he's saying is we recognize there has to be a few more this year in order to be in a good place next year. Whether he can keep to that or not is a very big question. There was a letter from a number of senior Republican and Democratic figures, policymakers, former policymakers, an open letter that came out, I think it was yesterday or today, that essentially said, this is a good thing. More is needed. We do need to continue to engage in the security challenges in Afghanistan, and we may need to for quite a while. Whether the American people and the American politicians have the patience for that is a different matter entirely.
Well, let's move seamlessly along on the subject of delicate diplomatic negotiations. EU foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini has this week become the highest-ranking European diplomat for some decades to visit Havana. The obvious backdrop to this is the recent announcement of an end to America's absurd and counterproductive blockade of the island. Ms. Mogherini expressed hope that a formal deal between the EU and Cuba could be concluded before this year is out. Oscar, are we now seeing the race to get into Cuba before the Americans snaffle up everything?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And what you have behind, what you can see behind that race is obvious economic interests. We know that Spain has invested a lot in Cuba's tourist industry, which is going to be the main industry in a scenario, a post US-Cuba normalization scenario. So the Europeans want to be there. Obviously, the finer points of diplomacy here and the problematic points have to do with the fact that the Cubans want the European Union to drop their common principle and the common policy on tying improvements in human rights and so on with trade. The Cubans want that to be dropped. If the Europeans do so, then we'll kind of face the truth of these negotiations.
Zania, as Oscar was alluding to there, there's been a certain frostiness between the EU and Cuba, nothing like the froideur between America and Cuba. I mean, it's been perfectly possible for years to fly directly to Havana from any number of European capitals. I think something like a third or thereabouts of all the tourism Cuba gets, EU nationals. What has been the reason for that slight iciness? Is it just the EU trying to stay in some sort of lockstep with the US, or have there been separate concerns?
Well, I think it's separate concerns in this case. Unlike, say, China policy, Iran policy, where the US and Europe, Russia policy, has tried to maintain some kind of lockstep, I think it's probably going a little far, but common ground. Cuba has been a somewhat different situation. The American policy, as you suggested, has been fairly extreme, shall we say, for the last number of decades. The European policy has not been the same at all. The negotiations between Europe and the US were essentially frozen after there had been a crackdown on dissidents and journalists, activists and journalists in Cuba. I think now with the American dialogue hotting up again, Europe's just decided that it needs to engage too. I think a lot of it is about competition. I agree with Oscar, competition and about trade and everybody wanting to get in first. And as Oscar identifies, the real issue for the Europeans is, are they going to maintain those ties between human rights and engaging in trade agreements and engaging in a closer relationship? And if they do make the closer relationship and the trade ties incumbent upon continuing to open up on human rights, the Americans may beat the Europeans to the punch.
Oscar, do you get the sense, I guess, looking not so much at the EU's views of Cuba, but the wider repercussions of America's initiative throughout Latin America, that Latin America has yet figured out how this recalibrates everything? The idea, because for so long, so much of Latin America has looked at the United States through the prism of Cuba. It must be confusing South America in much the way that the Middle East would be suddenly baffled if Israel and Palestine sorted themselves out.
Yes and no. Yes, because it is very confusing to see the U.S. Getting closer and closer to Cuba while at the same time going further and further from Venezuela. So that's it's sending very mixed signals. But no, insofar as for most Latin Americans, it is absolutely clear that the U.S. wants to re-engage with Latin America, not necessarily in the best terms. So they see the opening of relations with Cuba as a sort of good cop versus the bad cop policy, which most of them see everywhere, not just in Venezuela, but also in Ecuador, even in Brazil.
Zania, I'm assuming that the EU would be regarded from a Latin American perspective as the slightly better cop. But what would the EU itself have to gain from reconciliation with Cuba? It is Cuba's second biggest trading partner after Venezuela. But is the importance reciprocal? Does Cuba really matter to the EU?
You identified it as trade. I mean, it's absolutely trade. Latin America is increasingly in Europe and in the US for that matter, becoming a more central part of the global picture. It's one of the few parts of the world where there don't appear to be massive conflicts about to break out. There is potentially significant trading potential there. There is energy potential there. I think more and more beginning to look at that region as an area that you could engage without some of the potential costs that you're seeing elsewhere. But always, 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 there is this tension between opening up trade and issues like democracy building, human rights, whether you're talking about, I mean, this is very much an issue that's part of the negotiations with Russia. It's very much an issue that's part of the negotiations with China. This is just one more case of trying to find that right balance between maintaining standards and values and yet also engaging.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Zania and Oscar will still be here when we return. Up next, we will be looking at the Thai Prime Minister's interesting ideas on press regulation, Japanese military recruitment, and suggestions of floral skullduggery at the White House.
Our first Monocle Quality of Life Conference is taking place in Lisbon, Portugal, from Friday the 17th to Sunday the 19th of April. Over 3 days, and with the help of 20 speakers, we're going to reveal the best projects, people and practices helping to create dynamic cities around the globe. Guest speakers include the legendary typographer Eric Spiekerman, celebrated architect Bjarke Ingels, and the V&A's director Martin Roth. This is an intimate weekend, and we know that important conversations will continue long after the speakers have left the stage. So we'll make sure there's plenty of opportunities to talk at the receptions, at the final night's dinner, and beyond. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference in Lisbon, Portugal, from the 17th to the 19th of April. Find out more at conference.monocle.com.
They have reported, listened, watched, quizzed and cajoled. They've been to farms and galleries, conclaves and bars. They've reported from the high north and tropical metropolises. And you? Well, all you need to do is turn the dial, click our app, or pop in your headphones and head off on an audio tour of the spikiest, juiciest, funniest moments from Monocle 24's week that was. The Curator is our one-hour show that informs, entertains, and surprises with the best bits from all of our magazine shows. From the urbanist to the menu, the stack to the entrepreneurs, the culture show to Section D. Premiering live every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time. You can also subscribe to the programme at monocle.com or on iTunes or SoundCloud to ensure you never miss a beat. Come on, let's catch up this weekend. Listen to The Curator.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck University and Zania Wickett from Chatham House. Now, military dictators are not known for their high regard of the notion of a free press as a bulwark of civilization. Even so, today's remarks by Prayuth Chan-o-cha, leader of Thailand's ruling junta, are bracing. He suggested to reporters that they should do their jobs in a manner which would promote national reconciliation, by which he means, we may assume, reconciliation of the nation with the opinions of Prayuth Chan-o-cha. He mildly added that he would probably just execute those who dissented. Now, we should concede that some reports have suggested that he did follow this quip up with something along the lines of really ask a silly question. But Oscar, do we think at least he was giving some sort of voice to something he'd quite like to do if it was possible?
Don't you love it? I mean, this piece of news made me feel nostalgic of the time when bad guys did speak like bad guys and walk like bad guys. I remember John Berger saying that we can no longer recognize our tyrants because they wear ties and they look just
like. You want him sitting behind a big glass desk and stroking a white cat with a sort of a trapdoor leading to a shark tank in front of him in his office. He's quite close. Zania, he also said, and again, we could have fun unpicking this one, you don't have to support the government, but you do have to report the truth. Now, what do we suppose he meant by that?
The truth as he sees it. I mean, this isn't new. Yes, I mean, I think this is, even as a joke, this is pretty bad coming from the leader of a country, particularly when you look around the world and you see vast tracts of vast regions in the world where there isn't an open press, including in Asia, where people are arrested, where people are tortured for what they say, and there does appear to be a trend in some countries of the world where it's getting worse rather than better. So maybe he has a sense of humour. I think it was probably pretty inappropriate.
It does appear to be a classic case, if not actually, of shooting the messenger, then vaguely threatening to do so. He was apparently upset by an AP story, Associated Press story, about human trafficking in Thailand. I suppose, Oscar, it's not just a condition of dictators, but of politicians in general. Why do they always seem happier to actually blame the people who reported the story rather than actually sorting out the problem that the story was reporting on?
This may be the oldest trick in the book, sacrificial lamb. You have to externalize fears and threats so as to make people think that they have nothing to do with the real issues.
But looking at Thailand generally, Xenia, he seized power last May. He says Thailand still isn't ready for the lifting of martial law. This is far from the first time in recent memory, of course, in which the military have seized power in Thailand. Why can't or won't democracy stick?
The trouble is, and you see this in Thailand, you see this in Bangladesh very much as well. You have, actually, you can make an argument, you see this in the United States, you have incredibly partisan politics right now. There are two sides, and those two sides feel diametrically opposed about how the country should go forward. Thailand's been in this position now for at least, 5, 6, 7 years? And every time there's an election, the same result comes out, and you get either the red shirts or the yellow shirts out on the street protesting for years until it's changed again. The problem is...
It's become one of those political cultures in which reason is abandoned in just taking sides.
In which compromise is a dirty word. There is no moderate middle. You see it in Bangladesh. You actually saw a military coup a couple of years ago because, of course, you had the two battling who they call the battling Begums from two sides who couldn't actually function together and couldn't actually function in a democracy. The trouble is we've seen this before. You have a coup, you eventually have another election a year or 2 years down the road, and you get yourself exactly where you started until you get some new leadership.
Also, we shouldn't be hypocritical about it. Look at the reaction after the death of Lee Kuan Yew. Mm-hmm. Celebration. I mean, I saw Henry Kissinger in Newsnight pretty much celebrating this man as the architect of our globalized world. And when he was asked about his poor human rights record, mm-hmm. and that is a sort of aside.
Well, that was always Kissinger's big thing, though, and it's become a thing in Western foreign policy generally, this fetishization of stability above all other considerations.
It's not just a Western fetish. The reality is that most people, if you take it down to the granular level, most people will choose security and stability, even if it doesn't look quite how they'd like it to be, over insecurity and instability, even though it may be more open.
Do you think that's what the junta in Thailand is benefiting from, that anything for a quiet life tendency? And I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing. I've travelled and worked in places where a quiet life would be a blessing beyond measure.
Look around the world. Look at the Russians. Look at the Iraqis. Look at the Afghans. Look at the countries in the world that are right now going through enormous upheaval. There are an awful lot of people in those countries. Not all. Sometimes majorities, sometimes minorities, but there are an awful lot of people who will tell you, I just want it to go back to where I knew that I could walk out of my house every day and I could do my shopping and I could go to work and I could survive.
The difference is, and here we can go back to Appelman Williams's article reprinted in The Nation. Before, yes, there is the traditional right to defend what we have, security. But we now want perfect security against all future contingencies. That's a problem.
And the other problem is that stability now doesn't mean stability in the future. A system whereby you don't have an opportunity to blow off steam, which is effectively what democracy does, is an unsustainable system. We haven't seen it survive anywhere. And so we are sacrificing essentially security or stability today for stability tomorrow.
Okay, well, let's look now at Japan, which has recently been pondering, at the urging of its Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, a redefinition of its military, an officially passive entity known formally as the Self-Defense Forces. Possibly for this reason, recruitment has slumped recently, down 10% in 2014. The SDF are hoping to address this through the medium of cutesy smartphone games. To the extent that it's possible on the internet, Oscar, I'll ask you first. I've had a look at these games. I'm no particular video game aficionado, if that is indeed the word. But these games do suck. I mean, they are way more Donkey Kong than they are Call of Duty. But how is this going to help?
This always happens. You know, governments always misread what they think youngsters like. So they produce things like this. If you, I'm sorry, your listeners cannot see it because it's absolutely wonderful. You have like tanks and helicopters coming out of a house, and three soldiers in karate positions, smiling as if they were Hello Kitty. It sucks.
On social media, though, by some accounts, people have been complaining that these games are too difficult, which actually led me to wonder, is this a cunning psyops means of weeding out the unsuitable? If they sort of go online saying, I can't figure out this game, it's too hard, that they're not really frontline material, are they?
So, reading this piece, you know, there are flying apples. You have to avoid the flying apples.
Well, that's the good advice, avoiding flying apples. That can hurt.
Well, exactly.
Particularly if you're Isaac Newton.
So, who knows? I personally used to kind of like Donkey Kong, but then maybe I'm not exactly the person that they're looking for here.
I mean, I used to like Donkey Kong, but it did not inspire me to climb up ladders over falling barrels to attack a gorilla.
I don't even know where to go with that. Is that something that you...
Well, I think that they're hoping that these games will inspire people to sort of like make haste to their nearest recruiting office.
Look, I'm sorry, but I think as per the piece, the Chinese got it right. The Chinese military, let his players fight enemy forces in islands disputed with Japan. Now, that looks like the real thing. That's how you get some people to join the army. But
is it possible that the Japanese have just forgotten what a military really does?
You know what, you say that, but actually, Japanese self-defense forces are actually some of the best in the world. I mean, you know, yes, they're defensive rather than offensive, but most people, including the Americans who have trained with them, who have done joint trainings and the like, say that they're actually an incredibly capable force. So maybe they know something that we don't know. Maybe there's a you know, you look right and they're coming at you from the left. You know, maybe we need to think of it in those terms.
Just the people you want on your side if you're being pelted with large quantities of apples.
Yeah, but what do you have to say about the SDF putting its officers on the runway as models at Tokyo Boys Collection?
They could be, I don't know, it could be camouflage.
It could be the worst fashion week ever.
You never know. Finally tonight, though, we have only a couple of minutes left, so we shall return to Washington, which is a city apparently agog at the revelation that last month, Laura Dowling, who had served as the White House florist for 6 years, was escorted from the premises. The White House and former flower arranger have both now issued blandly upbeat statements. But what are we not being told? The Washington Post broke this story beneath the headline, "The White House head florist is gone and no one knows why." Zania, should knows why have been replaced with the word cares?
You know what? This is the wonderful, you know, I mean, this is the kind of National Enquirer almost story. Like, yes. we have to have, you know, if you've got, you think of your front page, you've got the Middle East, you've got Syria burning, you've got Ukraine, you've got, you know, the Chinese creating toys to attack the Japanese. You've got to have that... You know, the White House florist has been turfed out, excuse the pun.
And yet the head,
I was hoping we could do this without puns.
And yet the headline is War of the Roses.
Beautiful. I mean, really, this is what is going to make us cheer, as it were.
We will have to leave it there. Zania and Oscar, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's show, which was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mike Hawin. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Marcus Hippie will be keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist at 1900 hours. Daniel is here with the entrepreneurs at 2200. I'm back with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. This show returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time, but for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.